Good morning. Good to see ya. I've been in this building now for a couple hours, so I've almost forgotten what it's like to feel like your face is being sandblasted just from breathing air. It's amazing, though, how dynamic it is where we live. And to think that people have been living here for thousands of years. If you're like, oh man, it's tough. Well, you got probably like heat in your house. It's amazing. It's amazing what people can do. So I'm going to base my talks today on a koan and a set of verses that I found in this new book that I'm excited about, which is called Zen Echoes. So Zen Echoes is a new translation of a text called Concordant Sounds Collection of Verse Commentary. The translation is done by Beata Grant, a woman of whom I'm a big fan, because she translated one of my favorite books, which is called Daughters of Emptiness, which is a collection of poems by Chinese nuns. And I use that as the basis for teaching and study quite frequently. So this is new, and she has unearthed another gem for us and translated it. This koan collection, with these three commentaries, the commentaries are all by, women, Miaozong, Baoqi, and Zukui. I'll get there in a minute. I just want to talk about the tradition that this comes from. So, when Zen was forming in China, we started to get what was called lamp records. So lamp records are these just a bunch of little, really short stories, and they're just stories of encounters between practitioners passing the lamp of wisdom and realization between each other. And they're quite wonderful and nearly incomprehensible. So if you've encountered koan literature, you probably already know this is true. If you haven't, you're in for a treat. And around maybe 1100 CE, we start to see these things where a prominent teacher would collect a bunch of koans that he thought were really great and then write verse commentaries. And so we ended up with three principal collections that are canonical now: the Gateless Gate, the Blue Cliff Record, and the Book of Serenity. But those books actually, the first person would go, these are great, and then write verse commentaries. And then their students or someone a little down the line would add some more. So you have like this kind of like a set of echoes of teaching. And I was really excited because I'd seen some koans and I said, I don't get this. This is like really confusing, you know. A monk asked Joshu, does a dog have Buddha nature? Joshu said, moo. And that's it. What do I do with that? What do I do with that? That's tough. So then I was like, oh, there's going to be commentary by Hongzhi. I love Hongzhi. I've read some of his stuff. It makes sense. But it turns out the commentary is just as opaque, almost without fail. So it's kind of funny because you think, well, they give you this thing you can't get, and then they obscure it somehow with these commentaries. What is that? But the tradition is based in the idea that we already know we want to figure things out and have an answer and have it set and think we know what's going on. And that is the problem. So koans, like the koan itself, is intended to challenge that aspect of your consciousness. And then you don't want to make a commentary to the koan that just says, oh yeah, and this is the answer, fine. Because then you've killed the koan. So this is the great danger of playing with koans, as I will be doing today. It's very easy to kill them and just be like, oh, look, now I have a butterfly on a board. So I hope to try and keep this butterfly alive, as I really think Miaozong, Baoqi, and Zukui did with their verses. Anyway, so you have those three sort of those canonical sets of koans and commentaries. And this one was fairly recently discovered, dug up from a fairly obscure status within the body of literature in China by Beata Grant. And Miaozong was actually a quite prominent teacher in her time around 1100 or so. And she compiled a bunch of verses. She wrote her commentaries. It's cool. They're great. And then 500 years later, Baoqi and Zukui found them and were like, this is great. and they added some verse commentaries. I don't think it's an accident that they found probably the most prominent female teacher of their tradition. And then 300 years later, Beata Grant finds it. And then I found it. And you guys are going to find it. So we'll let this echo around, these Zen echoes, and see what happens. So I'm going to begin by reading the case. And the great thing about this case is it actually kind of makes sense. So it's nice. Nice starting point. This case called Angulimala and the Difficult Delivery. After Angulimala had left the householder's life and become a monk, he went into the city with his begging bowl. He came to the home of a wealthy man whose wife was having a difficult delivery. The man said, "As a disciple of Buddha, you must be very wise. Is there not something you can do to spare my wife this difficult delivery?" Angulimala replied, "I have only recently entered the way and yet do not yet know any way of doing this. I will go and ask the Buddha and then return and tell you." Wouldn't that be nice if you just, I'm confused. Let's go ask Buddha. And so he returned and explained the matter to the Buddha, who then told him, "Go quickly and say to him, in all the time I have followed the saintly and sagely way, never once have I taken life." Angulimala went back and told the wealthy man. As soon as his wife heard this, she gave birth. Both mother and child were fine. So if you're one of these people who really thinks it's great to talk about how Buddha is just like a total rational set of empirical truths, just read this again and see what happens. There's something miraculous in here, right? How about that? I like rational empirical thought. I think it's great. Anyway, so does anyone know by any chance the there's a contextual element that if you know it because you know this body of literature, you'll know there's something very startling about this story? Angulimala, his name means garland of fingers. So he was one of the most notorious mass murderers in northern India at the time and used to wear a necklace of human fingers of people that he had killed. So if you don't know that, you're missing something. The story still has some interesting power, but it's kind of funny they don't even mention it. Probably because this was kind of a famous story at the time, so it'd be kind of understood that you'd know that piece. So the Angulimala Sutra, which is found in the Majjhima Nikaya, is from the Pali Canon. Really old story. Basically, to sum it up, there's this terrifying mass murderer. Everyone in the whole area is freaked out. And Buddha says, "Oh, okay." And he just goes straight to where the guy is. Everyone's like, "No!" And then they meet. They meet and they have an intimate encounter. And Angulimala says, "Oh, I'm going to completely change my life. Can I become a monk?" Buddha says, "You bet." And then the Buddha has Angulimala stay by his side for a while. People be coming around and go, "Buddha, you got to help us. There's this crazy mass murderer." And he'd be like, "Oh, are you talking about this guy?" And then this story happens around this incident where Angulimala is touched by seeing this woman suffering through this painful childbirth. A person who probably was not real strong on compassion before. So, here's the context. And, you know, this is a tradition that emphasizes that each person always has liberative capacity. So there aren't people who are outside the pale because they're so bad or evil. Neither you nor anyone else, and with nothing about how you are. It's all subject to change, and that change can be liberative. And this is not only true for you, but it's true within the larger scheme of things. So it is quite possible, I think, for people to turn on the news and go, "What's the point? The problems I see out there are so intractable, I can't do anything about it." This is a radically non-Buddhist viewpoint. Or, this story is here to challenge us and remind us, oh, there's always possibility. So what we don't have... sorry, I'm looking at that clock being like, it's not 9:30. New schedule. It's like a koan. Anyway, so Angulimala in the full sutra from the Pali Canon, there's a little bit more fleshed out in this part of the story. And when he goes to the Buddha and says, "What should I? Is there something I can do?" The Buddha says, "Oh yeah, just go tell him, never in my life have I intentionally taken life." And Angulimala is like, "I can't do that. I've killed lots of people." And Buddha says, "Oh, well then just say, never since I've been ordained have I, ever since I've taken up the way, have I intentionally taken life." And Angulimala is like, "Well, that's true. I can do that." So in this case, what we see is Buddha just seeing the person now, taking birth, the freshness of our capacity to do something no matter what we have done in the past. Seeing in Angulimala, just present that. Present your harmlessness, your nonviolence, your ahimsa, present it now as birth. And which is like a useful viewpoint. But Angulimala also has a useful viewpoint. That's just not true by any conventional understanding, and I'd be lying. So these are kind of opposite views. And Buddha's like, okay, that's fine too. If you want to say it that way, do that. And we see here, I've never really thought about, born-again Buddhists. But there's a little flavor of that here, right? There's like a kind of a rebirth. That Buddha is seeing in Angulimala. And Angulimala wants to kind of follow conventional rules and conventional understanding. That's upheld by this. And the Buddha wants to uphold something much more vast, complete liberation in each moment. We say more like a view from the side of enlightenment or the absolute. Both are upheld. Both are good. Don't fall to one side. Too late. So, another thing that happens in this here koan is we have a birth. We have a mother giving birth. Probably not just a total coincidence that a collection of koans compiled by a woman holds this theme. Is anyone here familiar with the artist Judy Chicago? I'll bet you are. So Judy Chicago, one of her most famous things was called The Birth Project, and it was a massive affair. I don't know the details, but it was hundreds of works of fiber art by hundreds of women, all of them representations or relating to birth, but many of them just direct representations of birth. And Judy Chicago once famously said, "If men gave birth, there would be 1,000 images of the crowning." The crowning being the moment at which a child begins to emerge from the body of a woman. So, it's like a big deal. Like, infant mortality and mortality among women giving birth is still, like, thousands of people die every year from it. And millions, and like, we're doing way better than we used to be. And it's like, it's just kind of like hidden away. So, you go see like a superhero movie and it's like, pow, 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 we're all so brave. I was like, who's brave? Who's brave here? I went to see the movie Free Solo because I like mountains and climbing. It's a movie about a mountain climber. Alex Honnold, who climbed El Capitan 3,000 feet of extremely technical climbing without a rope. It was one of the most astonishing athletic achievements probably ever. And the movie is pretty amazing. And, by the end, everyone's like, oh, and it's like, people in many contexts, are doing these amazing, brave, challenging, difficult, and profoundly dangerous things, and a lot of them are pregnant women. And that story is rarely told. So, anyway, a little bit of context. Then we find Miao Zhang is going to provide a verse. Neither slow by a single step nor quick by a single minute, the clear-eyed patch-robed monk, how does he know what to do? Shattered bones and crushed flesh won't cancel your debts. One word of insight is worth 10 million words of apology. I'll just read that again. Neither slow by a single step, nor quick by a single minute. The clear-eyed, patch-robed monk, how does he know what to do? Shattered bones and crushed flesh won't cancel your debts. One word of insight is worth 10 million words of apology. It's neither slow by a single step nor quick by a single minute. You're always at the pivot of realization, and you're always in your one place where you have liberative opportunity, and it is this one. Always true. You can't get behind it, and you can't get ahead of it. You can't get better at it, and you can't get worse at it, because it's here. This is fundamental bedrock teaching of this tradition. You might be like, well, yeah, sure, I've heard that. I've got that one. Really? Have you got that one like in 4 hours when you're griping at your spouse? Maybe. This is something of which I need to be reminded all the time. So we tend to think that we're kind of like behind or catching up. We feel that way with our lives. They seem busy. You can't be busy. It's just an idea. You're always where you are. Busyness is just an idea that you're opposing on what you're experiencing to tell you that it sucks. You're here. I teach music. I'm a music educator. You know, when people are playing music and they're learning to play music, when they start it out and they're playing, they make a mistake and they're going to usually try and catch up. Well, first they're going to kind of act like they got stabbed. They make a face, or maybe they laugh. Ha ha, I made a mistake, whatever it is. And then they're going to try and catch up. So it sounds like this. Like if you have a little kid, it goes like this. Da 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 da. Oh, I missed it. Oh, I catch up. It'll be good. You can't catch up. This is one of the beautiful things about music, is that it illustrates this basic idea. You can't be behind or ahead. You're either wrong or you're on the right note. You can't catch up to it. You can either play another thing that's incorrect, or you can play the thing that's where it's supposed to be. That's now. You can play the now thing. What is it? So in teaching people, first it's like helping them to not have to stab themselves when they make the mistake, which isn't really all that helpful. And then teach them how to just go, oh, what is a monk to do? Where is the note? And then just play it. Don't run after it. Don't wait for it. Just identify what to do and do it. Well, you may feel like you made a lot of mistakes. You have to catch up for them. You can't actually catch up. You just do the thing now. Maybe I'll get to that in a minute, because the penultimate line of this verse is, shattered bones and crushed flesh won't cancel your debts. Well, Zen rhetoric has never been accused of being unwilling to be startling. Shattered bones. Good gracious. Miao Zhang. So the thing is, like, you might think, some people think, well, Angamila, he was a mass murderer. He should just be maybe tortured to death. That has been a common view throughout human history, and it still happens. people are being punished for crimes with violence all over the world. And you may be like, well, I never do that. But what is the theme here? Recognizing that harm will not repair harm. That underlies this thought. And, you know, you can look for where you subtly think that harm will somehow repair harm. Like maybe someone just needs to be insulted because they're just that bad. You would never do that. Maybe, though, stay out of the internet chat rooms. A place where there's a lot of that going on. Tomorrow is Dr. Martin Luther King Day. Best occasion for a holiday, I believe, that we have in our nation. Both to celebrate the astonishing achievements of Dr. King and the people who are working with him, but more importantly, to be reminded of the work to be done. Dr. King, of course, famously said, "Hatred, returning hatred for hatred adds darkness to a night already devoid of stars." Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hatred cannot drive out hatred. Only love can do that. Perhaps you know in the Dhammapada it says hatred cannot be ended by hatred, but by non-hatred alone is healed. And you might think, well, I'm not very hateful. You know, I'm pretty good. That's good. It's good if you're not. And if you are, it's okay. Because Angulimala, he's still part of the world. Those hateful part of ourselves need to be seen. Need to be met. But this nonviolence is not just about not doing unkind things. Nonviolence is part of a deep tradition rooted in the understanding of interdependence, interrelationship. Or as Dr. King would say, I am cognizant of all the interrelatedness of all communities and states, or we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, or whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly, and you could find a lot of quotes on this theme. Because the thing is, because things are interdependent, just not doing the violent thing just isn't enough, because you're still embedded in the violence. If you're not aware that you're embedded in violent systems, I think you should read the news more. If you're so overcome by the news that you're paralyzed and can't do anything, then you should read the news less. But if you can't recognize how there's complex systems that are harming people, we need to open up and recognize that we can't step out of that or pretend we're not a part of it. Well, we can pretend we're not a part of it. It's just not true, and it's not nonviolence. Our engagement with the world is inescapable. I think so. So this theme, that this is true, is the central theme of this koan. It's a koan about a mass murderer and giving birth. And somehow, him just saying this strange thing, ever since I've taken up the way, I have not taken life intentionally, somehow this birth miraculously occurs. I mean, it sounds miraculous. Of course, all the scientists are like, well, causation does not equal correlation, Ben. It could have just been a coincidence. That's true. That is really true. But I don't think they wrote this story down because of that. I think there's something else going on. We are presented with something miraculous, which is this relationship between killing and giving birth and choosing not to kill and stepping in to this liberative opportunity. Angulimala sees suffering, doesn't know what to do, but, well, maybe I can get some help. That was something to do. And then he takes that help and I don't know how this is going to work. You can't imagine he was like, well, I understand how this is going to work. He just tried, and then something happens. So the thing is, we want to think, We're trained to think that we can analyze how causes are going to produce specific results and then manipulate things so we can get the results we want. That is a normal training for, I suspect, all the people in this room. And if you look at the way you conduct yourself and the way your mind works, you'll see it's doing it all the time. So this is useful. It's a helpful thing, but it's limited and it's problematic because we don't see how profoundly interdependent things are, because we're bound by it. So we see like a narrow view of the causality. So here, this koan is presenting this like, how is this related? It's related. It can't not be because everything's related. Bauchi has another verse later on which really highlights this that I enjoyed. I came across it and I thought, duh! Like that. I made that face. So this is in response actually to the koan I cited earlier, what Jiaoju asked, does a dog have Buddha nature? Bauchi writes in response to this koan, the vastness of karmic consciousness is hard to prove. You can't prove why a butterfly in Borneo is related to the way you're thinking right now. It's hard to do. The vastness of the interconnections are too big to sort out. So that's why we don't want to deal with it. We want to like get something a little more narrow and clear that we can say we got it figured out. The vastness of karmic consciousness is hard to prove. But when Mr. Zhang drinks wine, then Mr. Li gets drunk. When Mr. Zhang drinks wine, then Mr. Li gets drunk. When Angulimala says, since I've taken up the way, I have not taken life, a woman gives birth. Can you see the similarity between these constructions where it's like, that actually doesn't make sense. Sorry. Bad koan. But what they're pointing out is the relationship is not linear and it's beyond what you're going to understand. When Mr. John drinks wine, Mr. Li gets drunk. So I used to get very drunk every day for years. And during that time, at one point, I said something to someone. I have no idea all the effects that my actions had on that time. But I remember years later after I quit drinking, and I haven't been drinking for many years, I ran into a friend. And he said, good to see ya! He was kind of toasted. And he said, I just remember what you told me all those years ago, that if I drank too much beer, if we drink too much beer, we're going to gain weight. So just like you, I switched to drinking whiskey. When Mr. John drinks wine, Mr. Li gets drunk. This is not predictable. And that little exchange showed me a glimpse of how my conduct related to someone else's life. But it was a tiny glimpse. We have no idea all the impacts of our actions and how all other people's actions impact us. It's far too vast to be understood. But it matters. So I'm going to move on to Bauchi's verse. A tree overgrown with weeds, a jade carved to perfection, a lonely and desolate spot, a view of elegance and charm. The young lad seeking out the source of the night fragrance sees nothing but the moon shining at the foot of the stairs. I just noticed this is like a series of images. That's a good way to write poems, by the way. I'm going to read it again. I just try and picture each thing. A tree overgrown with weeds, a jade carved to perfection, a lonely and desolate spot, a view with elegance and charm. The young lad seeking out the source of the night fragrance sees nothing but the moon shining at the foot of the stairs. So she starts out with this like polarities. Tree covered with weeds. This is kind of standard Zen imagery. Weeds growing up, the proliferation of mind, the proliferation of phenomena, things in their ever-changing form, oftentimes bound up with our suffering and our habits. When my hut was completed, it was covered in weeds, to quote Chertow. And then on the other hand, we have this jade carving to perfection. You guys ever go to the MIA and see the jade mountain? It's like this perfect, meticulously crafted object made out of something precious. So we have this very natural, kind of rough, and then, oh. And then you get the desolate, lonely spot and the view with elegance and charm. It's not just beautiful, it's elegance and charming. You picture like a British garden, nice Japanese garden, all laid out. So we have this kind of uncultivated mess in this. So yeah, Angela Mila was pretty messy. I mean, it's as bad as it could get, right? And then you could say, oh, he had cultivation, he transformed himself, and that's something wonderful. Cool. This is true. Your practice may be like this. You may be like, you know, I used to just be totally mean as hell to my brother. And now I'm not, because I did my practice and I figured out how to do it. That is very good. That is very good. Learning how to transform things we do that are harmful, using practice so we can do things that are more beneficial, is a big deal. It's important. And your practice can feel like this, and it can be valuable like this. On the other hand, the second half, though, the young lad seeking out the source of the night fragrance sees nothing but the moon shining at the foot of the stairs. Who's cultivating what? It's just, there's some seeking. What is that? What is that night fragrance? We don't even know exactly what we're seeking, but we seek. We do the practice. It's not even clear. I kind of feel like, why am I even sitting in this stupid zendo? What's happening? I already stopped yelling at my brother. Can I be done with this? And yet there's this seeking. And then, yeah, can the young man cultivate the moon? You can't cultivate the moon. It's already mooning. It's complete. And this is why I really invite you to practice here. Take time to practice here. You will find yourself just walking down to the foot of the stairs and looking out the window, and there'll be like a plume of smoke running up just behind the altar. And that's enough. It's complete. You'll walk up to the top of the stairs to hit the han, to call people to zazen, and there'll be the moon. And it's full. It's whole. There's wholeness. It's not your wholeness. You didn't become whole. You couldn't ever not be whole. You walk out of zazen one day and look out at the lake and just watch the breeze coming across the surface of the ice. And it'll be like snow. Just a puff of snow. It's like you've never seen anything like that before. And then another breeze and another puff of snow. And it's like something you've never seen before. And then another breeze and a puff of snow. Something never seen before. And you're playing the note that is now. You're not trying to catch up. You're not behind. You're not ahead. Zukui offers a verse. Smash and break open the fetters of gold. Lift up and flip over the platter of white jade. Others may be concerned about loss and gain, but nothing can touch one's peace of mind. Troublemaking! Oh, I know this style is Zen. Just, wah! Many cases that have these startling images of kind of shocking. Wah! Lift and flip over the platter? That's inappropriate in a place of practice. So the fetters of gold is a kind of a traditional symbol for the rules of ethical conduct of Buddhism, and then a platter of white jade is like a white circle, looks kind of like the moon, which is a classic symbol for enlightenment. He's just like, throw out the rules, throw out your enlightenment, throw out trying to get something. Just be free now. He's just saying, oh, all this talk, jump into it now. Play this note. What is it? Free from karma, free from enlightenment. Because this koan has got like, you know, Angula Mula's, it's all about like, what's my, is my karma bad? Is it good? What am I going to do with it? I got to take care of it. I got to recognize I made these mistakes. I need to do something different. That's good. Very important. Buddha's just like, here you are now. Do your realization now. Do your practice now. So these koans and these verses present this vision, in particular the koan itself, of letting go of trying to catch up or fix what we did in the past individually, and recognizing our liberative opportunity now in the context of everything being interconnected. So, like, one example, oh yeah, I just have to use this example. People say like, well, I don't say anything racist, so I don't think I have to worry about racism. So that's not recognizing the context. Right? So the idea is not to just be like, well, or like, I figured out how to not, I figured out, transform myself, so I don't act like such a jerk to women. Which was a pretty big project for me. And I could be like, so I'm done. But the thing is, I'm not done because I'm always still in the pivot of everything being interconnected. My liberative opportunity is not about me, it's about everything. And so that's going to require inquiry into what's affecting my mind, inquiry in what's affecting other people, and realizing what's that step I'm going to take that's not behind or before? What's that note I'm going to play that is actually correct for this entire situation that upholds everybody? And that opens up big questions. The question that Miao Zhang asks, what is one to do? So, if a koan doesn't open up questions, I don't know what it's for. Thank you. So I'm going to welcome other people to offer a step or a note. Comment, question, verse, response, anything.
I know nobody, you probably don't want an etymology, but I would bet unguli is cognate with ankle.
Finger. Bendy part. Proto-Indo-European for bendy part. Anyone else? Yeah.
I'm not trying to cause trouble. Lamp stories. So the passage of the lamp involves a teacher and a student.
Mm.
And something that happens there is that the teacher is recognizing that the student has done something. And they're now ready to become a teacher themselves. So koans, that's what these things are a lot of the time. It's about transmission. A consequence of that, as we all probably are aware, is that there are multiple Zen lineages,
mm-hmm.
right? Teacher A, student B, continuing, and oh yeah, there's another teacher over here doing the same thing. So there are all these branches. Working with koans, different lineages approach this in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So most of, probably all of them, you know, they can be subjects of Dharma talks. They can be something one studies in an attempt to understand the Dharma, maybe, or part of a group discussion. So in a sangha that I was previously a member of, that's in a different lineage, yeah, they did all that stuff. But in addition to that, in the Dokusan conversation between the teacher and the student, at some point, the koan that the student was working on would come up. And that was kind of the key. And if the teacher was not happy with what happened, he'd get you out of Dokusan. That always happened. Okay, so that's a different way of working with koans.
Mm.
The teacher that was my teacher in the sangha once gave a Dharma talk about working with koans.
Mm.
And he was saying, well, you know, what are they for? What? And he was saying, well, they're not really something you plumb to get a deeper understanding of the Dharma. You know, you don't really use them. They're not, that's not the point.
Mm.
What is the point? He said, for him, it's the only way that I can see what's up with that student.
Mm.
Present it to them and see how they, what note they play.
Mm.
So that was interesting. So there aren't these gems, you know, there's mm. something immediate, dynamic between teachers do.
Mm.
Okay, so this teacher of mine went on to disgrace himself.
Mm.
He behaved inappropriately with one of his students, and he's no longer a teacher.
Mm.
Now, in the interest of not elevating one lineage over another, that sort of thing has happened here too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a question of, oh, you're practicing with working with koans the wrong way.
Mm.
I'm not trying to cause trouble.
Yeah, doesn't seem troublesome to me. I mean, it's real, so that's not trouble. Yeah, well, I don't view any aspect of our practice or understanding here as being. It's not just going to get rid of all our human tendencies to cause harm. I mean, we will carry those. The basic teaching of Buddhism is that samsara is not infinite, but so big as to be almost infinite. Samsara being our patterns of creating suffering. So I think it's important to discern whether you want to look at what the practice does and whether it produces people who want to are moving in the direction you want to move. And it can be really discouraging. Seeing people do really harmful things who have done extensive training is painful and difficult. And it's unavoidable because it happens. But we can both, as a group, discern what we can do as a group to minimize the possibilities of these harms, and then individually discern. But finally, it's very clear that I haven't seen any type of tradition, religious or non-religious, that doesn't have people doing things that are harmful, but we can just keep working.
Ben?
Yeah.
I really appreciate you reminding me of the interconnectedness of us all through the koan and these teachings, that that I can't know. That's a great reminder to me for, you know, right speech, right action, what effect I have, and, you know, throughout time, even when I'm gone, what effect what I've done here on this planet will have for, you know, till it's not here anymore. It gives me pause, it reminds me that each moment is the opportunity, right? And the opportunity lies in the moment. And that to me is, you know, I can study that every single time. I'm not doing it.
Yes.
Yeah. So thank you for bringing that up again in a different way through these koans.
Thank you. Thank you, Carrie. Well, we probably better call it here. It's been really lovely to have a convening of you with you this morning, and I hope to get a chance to talk to you during tea time.